It's a March morning, like any other in Manhattan. Temperature just above freezing. It's going to be overcast.
Picture this. 5 20-something-year-olds hanging around a townhouse in New York City.
One of them, Ted, is about to head back to the store. He needs cotton, but he's not sure what kind. Cotton batting or cotton balls.
Then there's a guy named Terry. He's working on something in the basement. Sitting next to him, a woman named Diana. There are also two other women, both named Kathy. One is in the shower. The other Kathy is ironing sheets.
It's her dad's house. He's coming back from a Caribbean vacation that evening. So that Kathy wants everything to be spotless. Then, something happens. Within seconds, three of them are going to be dead.
An explosion in Greenwich Village.
An expensive townhouse in New York's Greenwich Village was destroyed by three explosions.
An explosion destroyed an elegant Greenwich Village townhouse.
A series of explosions leveled this Greenwich Village townhouse.
This is Shoe Leather, an investigative podcast that digs up stories from New York City's past to find out how yesterday's news affects us today.
This season, we're going to 1970 Greenwich Village. A townhouse suddenly explodes, and authorities find out that it's ground zero for the operations of the Weathermen, a radical group of young revolutionaries who use violence to, quote, bring the war home. The explosion has been written about many times over the years, but if you dig deep enough and go back far enough, you find there's still so many questions about what actually happened.
Like, who was in the house when it exploded? How many people were there?
And what about the bomb? The one those 20-something-year-olds were building? Who or what was the target? I'm Zach Jaworski.
And I'm Alexa York. This is Shoe Leather, Season 7, Revolution Gone Wrong. You're listening to Episode 4, The Explosion.
I came home that afternoon, and it was probably around 4 in the afternoon, something like that.
Jean Rudolph was 15 in 1970, a high school student.
That I got out of the subway, walked up the stairs at 12th Street and 7th Avenue, and saw this huge column of black smoke in the sky. I just kind of said to myself, what's going on?
It didn't take him long to realize that something was on fire. That something was a house. Barricades and emergency vehicles stood between him and his home.
Flames, leaping up out of the building. It was like a real, honest to goodness fire. It was just raging. So I convinced one of the cops at the corner that I actually did live on that block, and he let me go in.
John remembers walking down the street, back to his family's townhome. He found the building supervisor on the stoop with who he thought might be an insurance adjuster.
They were both kind of commenting, well, this looks bad, but I don't think it's really as bad as it looks. And speculating that there had been a gas main explosion that caused this.
And that idea caught wind. A gas explosion. At this point, the word bomb isn't even part of the public conversation. According to newspaper archives from the time, there are three explosions in the house. The first is so strong, it blows a car-sized hole in the wall. It might have come from the basement. John is still standing on his front stoop. It seems like everyone in the village is. No one wants to take an eye off what's left of the townhouse.
Then after standing out there for maybe half hour, 45 minutes, I went into the house and, probably had a snack or something and then probably came back out again to watch what was going on.
But besides the explosion, something else is different about that day. John says his dad was home, rather than in the office, and he has a front row seat to what happened.
My dad had a study that faced the street. It was on the second floor, and apparently he was in his study when the blast went off, and he looked down the street, looking to his left, looking basically to the east on 11th Street, and he saw two women run out of the building right after the blast, and he said they looked like they were wrapped in bed sheets, and they ran into a small apartment house that was across the street.
The New York Times reports that too. When rescue workers get to the scene, they find two women on the first floor. They're naked and confused. They're taken to a neighbor's house. Nobody knows who they are.
Lindsay Van Gelder was a general assignment reporter at the New York Post. That means she'd get sent to cover a lot of random stories.
Well, we were all kind of desperate to find some kind of handle onto this story because nothing was happening.
But the real attention draw is the townhouse's famous neighbor. Dustin Hoffman is still riding the wave of popularity off his breakout role in The Graduate, a tale of forbidden love between teacher and student.
Where there would be a clump of reporters standing somewhere, in this case outside the townhouse, and kind of milling around, and maybe once in a while, someone, you know, like it was a big deal one day when Dustin Hoffman breezed by, or if, anybody who had anything to do with the townhouse showed up.
The stories say that Dustin Hoffman went into his damaged apartment right after the explosion to save some of his most prized possessions, oil paintings and a Tiffany lamp. But back to the rest of the scene.
The entire area is roped off. 23 families are evacuated.
A retired fire marshal hops out of the cab when he sees the fire. He tells rescuers he heard a child cry in the rubble.
Someone else said they heard one woman cry out, "Adam, where's Adam?"
Other reports say three men run from the house, hop a fence, and disappear.
What's left of the townhouse's red brick facade lies on the sidewalk in front of where it once stood.
And then, early that evening, fire crews find the body of a man near the front of the building. He's covered in rubble. 2 days later, they identify him.
The body of a man, identified as 23-year-old Theodore Gold, was pulled from the wreckage.
It's Ted Gold. Ted, the Columbia student, the one who went to commie camp, who was dedicated to the cause.
Gold was a member of the Weathermen, a radical faction of the SDS.
He's on his way out the door when the explosion happens, on his way to the drugstore. One eyewitness tells reporters that Ted was taking out the trash just a few minutes before the explosion. His body is crushed by debris. His autopsy says he died of asphyxiation. Then, a day later, a second body is found. An unidentified woman, and next to her, dynamite, loads of it.
Near her, firemen then uncovered 60 sticks of dynamite. Some of them stuffed in lead pipes, other sticks tied in small bundles and fused. Officials now believe the house was being used as a makeshift bomb factory.
The story of the townhouse is changing from that of an accident to a tragedy.
It takes some time to figure out the second body. She's Diana Auten, the 28-year-old.
That is 28-year-old Diana Auten, a former poverty worker and teacher and a member of the SDS Weatherman faction. She was the daughter of one of the richest men in the small town of Dwight, Illinois.
And she is remembered, too, as she was in less violent days, by her father.
Have you known that she was politically involved this way?
Oh, yes. We've discussed this often.
You've talked with her often?
Yes, about this, and I've talked about this movement.
The last time James Auten saw his daughter was a couple months ago at Christmas.
I've known that, that this is something that has been moving forward for months or years. And I know that Diana was a lovely girl, and she...
Newspapers report that Diana's body is discovered near a workbench in the basement.
She's decapitated and missing several limbs. Nails are embedded in what remains of her, and every bone in her body is broken.
The remains of Terry Robbins would not be found for another week, and it takes months to realize who it is.
He and Diana were closest to the dynamite when the bomb went off, and like Diana, Terry's body is also described as badly mutilated. He's not identified until May, when the Weather Underground confirms it's him.
Here's Lindsay again, the reporter.
there was barely a degree of separation between young reporters and young radicals. Most of us were recently out of college. Many of us had been student activists in college. A few people were friends with people who later became leftist radicals in the headlines. I remember personally just thinking that this was, you know, a horrible waste and bad politics. And the fact that they killed themselves while doing this was, you know, a terrible tragedy.
Lindsay remembers it changing the way she felt about the leftist movement.
There was a reason I was a reporter, and that was I wasn't, you know, bombing military installations. I mean, in that era, I remember losing a certain amount of sympathy for the people who were bombing.
It's now a couple of days after the explosion. Authorities are only now trying to piece together what went wrong.
People were still not quite clear what had happened in the actual explosion. These women who had escaped the house, nobody knew where they were.
Let's focus on those women for a second. The two who had been seen running from the house. One of them is identified almost immediately. Kathy Wilkerson. It isn't difficult. Her father owns the house. And based on identification papers found in the rubble, police suspect that Kathy Boudin might be with her, the other Kathy.
The pair is supposed to appear in a Chicago court later that month for their role in protests months before.
At any rate, the Kathy's lawyer says he expects them to be there.
But they'll never show up.
Investigators are starting to piece things together. They figure out what Terry and Diana were doing in the basement. They discover the makings of a pipe bomb. And they assume the explosion is a mistake. They trace the numbers back on the dynamite. 4 days earlier, one of the five weathermen went to a small town in New Hampshire with a fake ID.
The purpose? To buy 100 pounds of dynamite. Two cases, 100 sticks. Something that now requires a permit. In fact, there was so much of it at the townhouse that not all of it went off at first. John Rudolph, the kid coming back from school the day of, remembers police getting rid of it.
At that point, they brought in the bomb squad, and the bomb squad had this flatbed truck with this kind of dome structure that was mounted on it with these heavy metal plates and heavy chains. And the idea was that they would take the unexploded dynamite and put it inside this, it looked like a giant igloo painted red.
The dynamite recovered from the Greenwich Village house was detonated safely this afternoon in a New York police firing range. Dynamite that can be bought just for the asking without significant legal restriction in 38 different states.
The nails, most likely to create shrapnel. Bombs like that aren't designed to take out infrastructure. They're designed to take out people, scores of them at a time. At least, we looked it up online and couldn't find a single instance of nail bombs not being used on people.
In recent months, there's been a wave of bomb explosions in New York City. Since November, 16 blasts have killed at least two persons and in some cases caused extensive damage. Only last week, an explosion destroyed an elegant Greenwich Village townhouse where police believe young radicals were manufacturing bombs.
Now, if the Townhouse Collective was so focused on building a bomb, just who or where was the target? To find out where the dynamite was meant to go off, we went back to the newspaper archives, to the very beginning, March 1970. A week after the explosion, Newsweek magazine reports the target was Columbia University. It says the weathermen had been drifting into New York City for weeks before the explosion, from Boston, Chicago, and elsewhere.
Other outlets report the same thing, that Columbia is the target. Some of them attribute it to the Newsweek article.
Officials, including the mayor at the time, refuse to confirm or deny the Newsweek account. They just say that it would be investigated.
Even more than a decade later, a version of the Columbia story is retold in the New York Times. This time, it's reported that an ROTC dance at Columbia was a target. But there's a pretty key problem with that story. ROTC was suspended at Columbia a year earlier, in 1969. But here's the thing. The story is remembered so differently now.
When Lindsay Van Gelder was reporting from the scene of the townhouse explosion, she doesn't recall a lot of talk about who or what the weathermen planned to bomb. But here's how she remembers it today.
Weren't they going to use the bombs at Fort Dix or something like that? It was some military installation?
Not Columbia University, but a military installation. And in the beginning, that's what we thought too. When we first started reporting this podcast, we had read that the bomb that went off in the townhouse was meant for a military building.
More specifically, a dance hall in Fort Dix in New Jersey, one of the main training grounds for U.S. soldiers going to Vietnam. That's what our early reporting told us. It's even what former members of the Weathermen told us, and it made sense.
From the United States Army Training Center at Fort Dix, New Jersey, these are the sounds of basic training.
Since the war started, more than 2.5 million U.S. service members have been sent to Vietnam. In 1969, the number of active U.S. soldiers there peaked at more than 500,000. James Warwick is a historian at Fort Dix.
Obviously, the Vietnam War is in full swing. Fort Dix was starting in 1947, Fort Dix was an Army basic training location. So there were thousands of basic training troops here.
Warwick said that if someone was being shipped off to Vietnam from the Northeast, odds are they were funneled through Fort Dix.
One of the ranges on Fort Dix, on a Fort Dix range complex, they actually built an entire Vietnam training area that had, all of the booby traps to become familiar with. They had role players that were dressed like the Viet Cong. I mean, they tried to make the training as realistic as possible to prepare soldiers for what they would experience.
About 1,000 of them a month were coming out of basic training there. The story goes that the bomb was meant to be used on Friday, March 6, 1970, the night of the military dance. Only problem, there's no record of a dance that night.
They had listed Fort Dix as one of their targets, but after talking with you, it seems like that's not the case.
I don't have anything in my archives as I was looking through things. I have a lot about the anti-war, movement that was pretty robust here in the Fort Dix McGuire Air Force Base area, but I didn't really find anything related to any plots associated with the Weather Underground.
So where did the story about the dance at Fort Dix come from? And which one is right? Is Columbia University the target, or was it Fort Dix?
When I started actually working on the book, the people I talked to were not people who were in Weathermen, but who knew them.
That's Ron Jacobs.
Most of them were all pretty certain that it was Fort Dix. And I never really heard anything about the possibility it was Columbia till I started looking at some early mainstream news stuff.
In 1997, he wrote a book about the Weather Underground called The Way the Wind Blew. It came out a whole 27 years after the explosion. And it was the first reference we could find about a military dance being the target. Ron remembers who told him that. It was a Columbia student at the time. A close friend of Terry Robbins, a former leader of the Weather Underground, the one who came up with the name Weatherman.
His name was John Jacobs. Me and JJ only talked to each other like once or twice. They were very brief conversations because he was very paranoid. Basically, he confirmed that it was that he understood the target was supposed to be a military dance.
Ron was only able to corroborate that through underground newspapers and one other source.
One guy told me this, and he was not in Weather Underground, but he used to sell LSD to them.
Which basically traces that idea back to one reliable source. But the Fort Dix part still showed up several years later.
When Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn and a couple of the other folks released the collection of all their communiques and stuff on Seven Stories. It was called Sing a Battle Song. Mm-hmm. And they have a timeline in there. And the timeline is where they mention that they also say it was the bomb was going to be used at a dance at Fort Dix.
It seems that might have been enough to shift the narrative.
Perhaps there is another theory to consider, though. police found 4 unexploded bombs in the basement of the townhouse. I mean, the FBI called it a, quote, bomb factory. And look at the time. According to the FBI, in 1.5-year stretch between 1971 and 1972, there were more than 2,500 bombings on American soil. That averages out to nearly 5 a day.
So maybe there was more than one target, or maybe there were several. After all, bombings were the rage back then.
But you know who would know? The ones building the bomb. They surely know where they were meant for. And at least 2 of them survived the explosion.
In Chicago, a criminal court judge today issued arrest warrants for 6 young women. 2 of the missing, Kathleen Wilkerson and Kathy Bodine, are also being looked for by New York police who want to find out what they know about an explosion that killed 3 persons in Greenwich Village recently.
Remember those women, the 2 Kathys, wrapped in bedsheets after the explosion? Well, police do too, and they're looking for them.
2 of the missing, Kathleen Wilkerson and Kathy Bodine, are also being looked for by New York police who want to find out what they know about an explosion that killed 3 persons in Greenwich Village recently.
One of the Kathys was in the shower when the bomb tripped. The other Kathy was on the first floor. The pair crawl out of the rubble together. Most of the papers report that the women and bedsheets then got taken in by a neighbor, an older lady. She lends them some clothes.
And when she's out of sight, the 2 Kathys rifle through her closet. They find a single subway token, long before the Metro card. They walk to the subway station on 6th Avenue, go through the turnstile together, and disappear into the hundreds of miles of New York subways.
Both girls disappeared shortly after, and authorities now think they're hiding out in Canada.
The police don't have many leads. And now the FBI is involved. They send detectives across the country. Chicago, upstate New York, and even Canada. Still, nothing turns up. At any rate, the Kathys aren't found.
The Kathys and other weathermen go undercover and become the Weather Underground. They change their clothes, hair, and move to new places. Above all, the Kathys don't want to draw attention from the police or the FBI.
And for a long time, they're pretty good at it. Until about a decade later, when one of the Kathys shows up. And she's run into more trouble.
Yeah. I'm going to need an ambulance. Somebody just yelled out, I need an ambulance.
222 to all cars and stations, 10-5, 1-1 on an armed robbery. Just a car, 91 more.
Find out more on the next episode of Shoe Leather.
Shoe Leather is a production of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. This episode was reported, written, and produced by Alexa York
and Zach Jaworski. Joanne Ferrion is our executive producer and professor. Rachel Quester and Peter Leonard are our co-professors. Special thanks to Austin Mitchell, Brendan Klinkenberg, Asta Chattavetti, Dana Chivas, Zoe Chase, Brent Katz, and Columbia Digital Libraries.
Sources for this episode include Emily Schmidt, The Way the Wind Blew, Fort Dix Historical Archives, ProQuest Database, and the Archives of the New York Times. Shoe Leather's theme music, Squeegees, is by Ben Lewis, Doron Zunas, and Camille Miller, remixed by Peter Leonard.
Other music by Blue Dot Sessions. Our season 4 graphic was created by Hope Zhu.